One good way to introduce this particular podcast is to go to biblical texts, to indeed the New Testament, Matthew 7:16, by their fruits shall ye know them. I put to Ruth Weiss, my very special guest, professor of Yiddish literature at Harvard University, and the author of a new book about Jewish humor, I put to you, Ruth Weiss, this variant on Matthew 7:16, by their jests shall ye know them. Or if we want to be a little bit more borscht belty, I might say, by their yaks shall ye know them. Does that make any sense? Is there something distinctive, as indeed you argue there is, about the humor of the Jews?
Well, I do argue about certainly the distinctiveness in the sense that you would not write a book about Jewish humor if you did not think that there was something specific to say about Jewish humor. But one of the points that I do try to make is that if it is distinctive at all, it's less in the way that one can formulate a theory about Jewish humor than in the way one can formulate a theory about the amount of Jewish humor. So one of the things that I try to point out is that in the modern period in particular, Jews have become noted for their humor, and that they feel that there is a great value in humor, a value which they are developing. So it's really the amount, it's really the quantity of Jewish humor that is sometimes surprising, and the role that it plays in Jewish culture.
And in this country, that is in the United States, and possibly also in your native country, Canada, it is generally asserted that humor is largely in the hands of the Jews, particularly the kind of humor that is featured in showbiz, whether on stage, in the old Borscht Belt, on the modern stage, and, of course, in movies and television. Is that, in fact, the case? Does American humor essentially belong to the Jews?
Well, it doesn't belong to them, but in researching this book, I was surprised to find that the professionalism that you're talking about, the professionalism of Jewish humor, does in fact seem to grow specifically out of the Borscht Belt, the so-called Borscht Belt, those hotels of the Catskills where Jews of New York in particular, but all the surrounding area, began to vacation. And for some reason, I mean, it's there that entertainment through humor became one of the specialties of that kind of vacationing. So that if you went to vacation elsewhere, I think, for example, in the Adirondacks, where I now spend some of my summers, there were many, many hotels in the Adirondacks, but nowhere in those hotels, which were not Jewish, do you see humor as any kind of a specialty. They must have had entertainment of a certain kind, but it was not necessarily humor. So my feeling is that humor begins to play the same kind of role in Jewish life in America that jazz begins to play in the life of African Americans, very much at the same time, and I think out of a similar need.
One great undertaking that might be viewed as a brand of Jewish humor is the theory of psychoanalysis. In the latter day, Freud has been pulled apart and reinterpreted, and interpreted essentially as wrong, at least, by many people who 30 or 40 years ago would have said otherwise. That is, the psychiatrists and the psychologists have largely rejected Freud. But taking a particular text of Freud brings us right back into, and indeed you use that text as your entry into the analysis of Jewish humor in your new book, whose title, I have not yet said, is No Joke, Making Jewish Humor, published by Princeton University Press. And, of course, Freud asserts that Jewish humor is simply the funniest and, as well, the most profound. His word, I believe.
Well, he says that there are probably no people in the world that make fun of themselves to the same degree. That's his contention, that there's no people that uses humor in the same self-deprecatory way. Now, it's interesting that even on that front, he has been challenged. There is someone who wrote that the Scots use humor in a very similar way. But even the person who makes that claim does not make it very forcefully. So I think it is true to say that what Freud noted was that there is that distinctive quality about Jewish humor. And I'm really glad that you draw attention to his book, because I happen to think that his book about wit or jokes and their relation to the unconscious is a fantastically interesting book.
Well, actually, it addresses a very general psychological intellectual problem. And that is, what is the very mechanism of humor? What is the nature of humor? One might well argue that though sometimes you get a sort of raspy sounds from chimpanzees that might sound like laughing, basically there is no other laughing animal, including the so-called laughing hyena. Humor seems to be human. And one has to ask, what then did it provide? How did it service us in evolutionary perspective as we became Homo sapiens?
Well, there are so many ways. In one of the things I say, let me count the vase.
Yes.
because they being woe in Yiddish. So there is an association between the woes and the joys of humor.
Yeah.
And I think that, in writing about Jewish humor in the various languages in which it was created, you see that it served many purposes, much more than one.
But I'm pushing even more broadly, beyond Jewish humor to humor itself, humor generically.
Sure.
It has been a problem all the way from, all the way from Aristotle, I believe. Certainly,
absolutely.
Freud addressed it. Max Eastman did a famous book on it, as did many others more recently. The very nature of humor. What is funny, and why does funny make us laugh, and how does that service us in our own lives? Broadly, Jews, Hottentots, and everybody in between.
Well, sure. But if you take it further, there's some kind of humor, slapstick, for example, that might appeal to a very broad audience. And there you can find that there's a kind of joking, physical joking in particular, that will draw together children and grown-ups, people of various languages. It's a kind of humor like slipping on a banana peel that will make everybody laugh.
One great modern Jewish comic, Mel Brooks, says exactly that in the following. He says, quote, tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall into an open sewer and die.
Yes, I love that. It's right. And
it's naming an embarrassing human truth, but it is true. It's the ultimate measure of schadenfreude.
Well, yes, but you see, that's there's the curiosity about it, that there is a kind of humor that mocks others.
Yeah.
And I think that some of the theorists of humor have described precisely that kind of humor, the humor of making fun of others, that sort of laughter. Jewish humor in the modern period, if it makes fun of others, does it in such a convoluted way that sometimes you don't know whether the people being made fun of are really the others or the Jews themselves. And so that wit turns in a variety of directions, and because of its complexity, it can probably only be understood by those people within the culture.
Since you run a great program on Yiddish language at Harvard, I'm going to indulge myself and tell you very briefly a Jewish joke that I've always liked a lot. I think I got it originally from my father. And if you'll allow me, I'll do it in Yiddish, and you can translate.
Okay.
It's simply this. An old man and woman are in bed one night, and it's a cold night, and the woman nudges her husband, and she says, Chaim, steh auf und vermach de Fenster, es ist kalt in draußen.
She says, Chaim, get up and close the window. It's cold outside.
And he snores, but she pokes him again and says the same. So he gets up and stumbles to the window and closes it and falls back into the bed, snores again, and then says, Nu, hab vermach de Fenster. Yes, es ist warm draußen.
Okay, so he gets back into bed and he says, so I've closed the window. So now is it warm outside?
Isn't that funny?
It is very funny.
Do you know that one?
Yes, yes, I
It's
do.
quite classic. Now, what's funny about, what's the mechanism of that one? And is there any way in which that is somehow distinctively or sort of figuratively Jewish?
No, well, there I would say that you see, there's where Freud's analysis comes in handy. He talks about the fact that what it does is it shifts, obviously, it shifts the emphasis. When you say it's cold outside, you expect it, the window, to have to do with closing it against the cold. But in fact, then when the punchline is, and so now, is it warm outside? Obviously, it plays on the outside and the inside, and just pushes the word from outside the window to inside the house, and there's the comedy, because that's obviously not what was meant.
Now, I'm going to invite you, since I've already put my foot in the water, I'm going to invite you to put both feet in the water. Give me two or three Jewish jokes that you think are, one, funny, and two, significantly Jewish in one way or another, and we'll elaborate what's Jewish about them.
Well, let's see now. Here's one, a Yiddish joke, right? Which puts us back at the end of the 19th century in Eastern Europe, I think. So two Jews are traveling by wagon along a narrow road, and they see boulders blocking their path. So they stop to consider what to do, and as they're sitting there in their wagon, another wagon approaches carrying two peasants. So the Gentiles get out, they roll up their sleeves, and they shove the rocks away. "There's goyish thinking for you," says one Jew to the other, "always with force." Now, you see, this is a, I find that a funny Jewish joke because, on the one hand, you can see that always with force, it is alluding to the fact that a lot of the contact between Jews and non-Jews had to do with the fact that every once in a while the Gentiles in the surrounding area might lose their temper, might give in to the imprecations of the priest or whatever it is, and really use their force against the Jews. So this idea of the Gentiles as always using force rather than brains became a stereotype in the Jewish mind. But here in this joke, of course, the stereotype is being used against the Jews themselves. These people just sit there thinking that something is going to happen, and they don't do the most obvious thing, which is just to get out and, move these rocks out of the
So
way.
that is certainly Yiddish humor reflecting the situation of the Ostjuden, of the Ashkenazic Jews of the Pale, at the
And
turn
make
into
fun
the
of it.
20th century. Let's go to the 21st century, and maybe to the suburbs of Chicago, where at a high-toned Reform synagogue, the services are over, and one fellow, a broker, stops to talk to his friend, the powerful lawyer, and tells him a joke. What would his joke be?
Well, how about this one? He might say, "A flight to Israel in late December is about to land. This is your captain speaking. This is the culmination of El Al Flight 761, and we welcome you to Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. Please remain seated with your seat belts fastened until the plane is at a complete standstill and the seat belt signs have been turned off. And to those of you who are still seated, we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year."
That is wonderful.
It is a good joke. Again, it's a
That's Jewish,
joke.
if that's not Jewish self-hate, it's a Jewish self-criticism. It's really saying, we're not as we should be.
Well, exactly. And I think that your two guys would laugh at it because, of course, if they are living within the Jewish world, it's very likely that they have been on one of these El Al flights to Israel, and they know that people push and will not listen to all the instructions. So it does seem to be self-critical. But I wonder whether there isn't something self-congratulatory in that joke as well, that there are the Gentiles so well behaved you know that they are Gentiles because they're the ones sitting there and waiting for the seatbelt sign to be turned off, et cetera, et cetera. But the same qualities that that are associated with Jewish entrepreneurship, with Jewish curiosity, with not necessarily following the rules as they were, but looking for new ways to deal with things. I mean, maybe that's also part of this phenomenon of not sitting quietly in your seat.
The great stand-up Jewish comics of the present era, though some of them are fading out. In fact, Jackie Mason announced only the other day, I think, that he's at last retiring from his career as a stand-up comic. But people like Jackie Mason, Groucho Marx, Lenny Bruce, very different sort of comic to be sure, Mel Brooks, whom we mentioned before, and Woody Allen, of course, George Burns, and the more recent ones, the fellow, what is his name, who had the...
Larry David.
Larry David, and the other one who had that great television series which will run forever.
Seinfeld,
exactly. I'm blocking on him because somehow his stuff never appealed to me the way all those others did. Each of them, in a way, has his own persona and represents perhaps a different trick of human nature or a different styling of human personality, but also, in some ways, maybe... their stylings of themselves are reflections of aspects or character traits which Jews tend to think belong to them. For example, take the aggression of Jackie Mason. He was on my radio program once, and we had a very good time. And at one point, he ended by he just broke into a riff about what Jews want, what Jews work at. So Jews want to be lawyer, doctor, and or great scientists, of course, and lots of them are. That's where it all comes from. Italians, they want to be murderers. Throw off that simple line. I laughed with a certain amount of pain, worrying about what he said. And to be sure, just as I anticipated, we had a small firestorm the next day of people representative of Italian organizations protesting that this had happened on the air and asking to come on the air, come on my program to rectify, which, of course, we quickly granted. And I had a fine conversation with the head of the Italian-American Association for something or other. But there's pure aggression and contempt somehow elevated to comic form. Groucho Marx is doing a very different thing, though he's also somehow asserting his superiority. But basically, he's doing wordplay and altering a kind of linguistic analysis almost as he finds strange meanings hidden behind the syntactic structure of something that somebody says to him. A guy like Seinfeld, I'm not quite sure what he's doing, but he's sort of a nebuch, but things work out well for him. I guess he represents, in a way, innocence. And I could, of course, raise the great question about Woody Allen, who appeals to me much more than Seinfeld does. Here, one quote from Allen. I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality through not dying.
Yes.
I don't want to live on in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live on in my apartment. Do these, I've mentioned four or so of these stand-up people, do they represent different, are they elaborating different aspects of Jewish self-consciousness?
Well, as you say, I mean, someone who really becomes a professional comic has to develop his own style because basically it's he who is drawing on himself in order to produce the comedy. And he can only produce this comedy out of himself. He's like an actor who is a creator of a comic personage. And you know, there are certain expectations that are associated with various characters. So you had Bob Hope, you know, not a Jewish, but Jack Benny, for example, is a good example.
Jack Benny elaborates a whole persona around one negative trait, namely his stinginess.
Exactly. That's the point. And so you know that every show is going to play on this stinginess and that's going to be very comical. And I think that, you know, I am a great fan of Seinfeld. He once asked you know, what he deals in. And he said, you know, the comedy is about nothing. And it is true that what he deals with are domestic situations, very simple situations, but some of them are, you know, really funny. There is the episode with Seinfeld and the dentist. And the dentist comes along and he says, you know, I've converted to Judaism. And it turns out that the dentist has converted to Judaism so that he can tell Jewish jokes. And it's a very funny episode. And then the end of it is extremely curious because Elaine says to Seinfeld, I don't understand. Why are you so upset about this? Is it getting to you? Is it getting under your skin because he is insulting the Jews? And Seinfeld says, no, it's because it's insulting to me as a comedian.
Uh-huh.
So there, it's very telling because the joke is, of course, the subordination of something that you think is more important to something that is you think is less important. But Seinfeld turns it around, and in that punchline, he is saying that, you know, his dignity as a comedian is more important to him than his self. And his dignity as a Jew.
You examine throughout the book, but particularly in the early sections where you're dealing with, say, Heinrich Heine and others in the German tradition, Jews within German culture in the late 18th century on through the 19th, you examine another theme which is central in some historic periods of Jewish humor, something that in German would be called simply Selbsthasse. Self-hate, and of course also the phenomenon of Jews converting out of Judaism or trying to represent themselves as not all that Jewish. And this was a theme not only in serious argumentation, but it was also a theme in Jewish humor itself at one point.
Sure. Well, yes, and I think that there it goes back to the woes we were talking about earlier. Whatever is painful is what Jews joked about. And certainly the mass conversions of Jews, in particularly in Germany, but throughout Europe in the 19th century.
Including Heinrich Heine and Karl Marx, among others.
Well, Karl Marx did not
himself. His
father himself,
did it, yeah.
Yes, his father did it for him. But many, many Jews converted, and some of them made fun of their own conversion, as Heine did, calling it his entry ticket to European civilization, but a very cynical remark, since it had not really been his full entry ticket to European civilization. He didn't get the job that he wanted to get through conversion. But in any case, I think that those jokes are fantastic, you know, for Jews, four converts together discussing, you know, having something in common. So one says, I converted for love. You know, I was in love with a Christian woman and she wanted me to convert, so I converted. Another one said, I converted for my career. Because, you know, I wanted to become a lawyer. I wanted to go to law school. The only way I could get in was through being a Christian. So I converted. The other one says, well, I was up for, the army. And they would have gotten me as a Jew. But this way, he said, I was able to get out of it. And the fourth one says, oh, unlike you, I converted because I saw the benefits of Christianity and I had the faith. And they say, oh, come off it. Tell it to the Gentiles.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a very anti-Gentile joke because it sort of says the only reason that a Jew would convert is because he has to. But the guy who says that he converted out of conviction because he actually wanted to, oh, my God, you know, who could believe that? Who could trust that?
I wonder if you had told that very story to an eminent Catholic bishop, and cardinal, namely Cardinal Lustiger of Paris, whether that would have brought a laugh or not. He, of course, was a Jew, a Jewish child, who during the Holocaust was hidden and protected, I believe in a Catholic orphanage or a Catholic school, and who did, surrounded by Catholics, become a Catholic, and probably, well, obviously with deep sincerity, enough to win him a cardinal's red hat. Because there you got the assertion, it was real. Would that have pleased him?
Yes, well, that's a good question, and I'm glad that that you raise it, because I don't know Lustiger enough to know whether it would have tickled him or not. So that has to do with his personality. I have a feeling that he's the kind of person who might have laughed at it. For all that, as you say, he certainly converted out of, I think, two kinds of conviction. One, perhaps out of being attracted to Christianity as a faith, but also because of gratitude to the church that had treated him as it had during the war and given him an example of humanity that was lacking in so many others. All of these subjects that are fodder for Jewish humor are first and foremost very serious. And that's, you know, one of the curious things about this book is that it tries to get at the serious roots of Jewish humor and the serious implications of Jewish
the
humor.
The ultimate challenge to Jewish humor and indeed to Jewish life was, of course, the Holocaust. And as well, the depredations against Jews issuing from the Kremlin. They didn't have a policy of genocidal destruction of all Jews, but the Jews became the enemy, and prominent Jews were sacrificed much more than were prominent great Russians, say, in proportion, that is. You, of course, have some chapters on the direct confrontation with the murderous intentions of surrounding peoples and surrounding despots. How did Jewish humor serve in the face of that onslaught?
Well, there was a, in many ways, some of the older jokes were just recycled and used in the ghettos. For example, we in the ghetto have become so pious. We always fast as if every day is Yom Kippur. We are riddled the way matzahs are riddled. I mean, this is a very internal, so it won't speak to people who don't know the intricacies of Jewish holidays. But what this kind of irony does is it takes every single Jewish holiday and turns it into an affliction. And so the Jew says, we're so pious because we are now suffering all these afflictions. But there's a sentence that was recorded in the Warsaw Ghetto, which is, for me, I mean, one of the most profound that I know of. That is the following. God forbid that the war should last as long as we are able to endure it. This is humor, if you will, or irony of a very, very deep kind. You know, when you say this, you think that the person's going to say, God forbid that the war should last longer than we are able to endure it. That would be the normal way of saying it. God forbid that the war should last longer than we are able to endure it, which would mean, I hope that it doesn't last longer than I'm able to live through it. But the person turns this around to say, God forbid that the war should last as long as we are able to endure it, meaning that the Jewish powers of endurance have become so great and they've had to, you know, they've had to deal with so much that one doesn't want to have to endure as much as Jews have been able to endure. It's a very bitter and profound, I think, kind of humor.
We're close to the end of the available time. I have a last major question I want to pursue. But before that, let me again make clear to all who are listening and have downloaded this podcast that my guest is Ruth R. Weiss. And one does need to point out that Weiss is not spelled the usual way, but it's spelled W-I-S-S-E, but pronounced Weiss, W-I-S-S-E. The title of the book, No Joke, Making Jewish Humor, the publisher's Princeton University Press. And I simply want to attest, as one enthusiastic reader, this isn't just a joke book. It isn't just a collection of Jewish jokes. To the contrary, it's a very serious treatise about a rather unusual and long-lasting people, and what use they have made of what may be somehow in the human reflexive repertoire provided by the later stages of evolution, namely the ability to joke and to laugh. But I would come to a last theme, which is very important in your book, and that is you seem to suggest to Jews maybe there's too much of this stuff. Maybe Jewish humor has a dysfunctional as well as a functional value.
Well, it's not the only strategy, and I think it's a wonderful strategy, and I think that a lot of Jewish humor developed, as I say, in conditions where it was a last resort, where you couldn't escape your condition, and so humor became one of the ways that you dealt with it. A couple of things happen in time. Look, America is very different. In America, for example, you have many opportunities to deal with your problems, to deal with your crises head on. You can deal with them creatively. You can solve them. You don't have to be ironic about them. You don't have to make a joke about them. You can actually grapple with the situation and change it. My point is that, that humor serves a very, very important purpose. But for one thing, when a situation is serious and, when there is something to get done, then there are other ways to deal with problems than by making fun of oneself in that situation. And I guess that's just one of the underlying themes of my book. It relates to other things that I've written over time. I try to do both things at once. One is to really appreciate and to show how varied Jewish humor is and how creative it is and how funny it is. But the other is to say, yes, that there can be too much of it. And the example I use is that Shalom Aleichem, one of the great humorists, says, doctors prescribe laughter, which is true. But then I say, yes, but doctors also warn against an overdose. And I think that's the balance that I would like to strike.
I'm so glad that you mentioned Shalom Aleichem. I should have thought to bring him up myself. I was reared on Shalom Aleichem in the Volksschule, the Abd Ring Volksschule in New York City when I was a boy. And just one of the grandest works in Western literature, really, are his stories from Chelm. The town, Chelm, Chelm, is defined as the town of fools, is it not?
Yes. Well, it is. There was a real city of Chelm.
Yeah.
Their inhabitants really were not altogether happy with the fact that they became designated as Fool's Town, but they learned to live with it. And Shalom Aleichem really creates other towns, Kasrilivke, Fosadoyevke. He creates these make-believe towns, these fictional towns, which he peoples with his Jews who always laugh off their difficulties.
But a young Hasid comes to the great rabbi in Chelm and asks him, why is the sea salty? And the rabbi ponders for a while and says, of course it is because that's where the herring live.
Yes.
Whatever. Yes. It's a displacement sort of mechanism, which is just utterly charming.
Well, right. Well, it is fool's town. Yeah. So yeah. It's the kind of foolishness that that people can laugh at. But that kind of foolishness is pretty universal, so that you do have these fool's towns in England. Yes. And so forth, yeah.
And we have traditions of jokes based upon assumed stupidity with reference to other peoples. Poles are very often very offended by learning about the Polish joke that used to flourish in America.
Yeah, well, yes, timing, how did you get, yes, there are many, many jokes. And in Canada, where I used to live, Newfoundland.
Newfies get the same treatment, don't they, yeah.
They get the same treatment. But I think that that's not the kind of humor that you find basically in Sholem Aleichem. The highest form of humor that you find in him, I think, if one can grade humor in that way, is when he moves from Hebrew to Yiddish, actually, when he plays like a musician on various tonalities within Jewish culture itself, and within the Yiddish language itself, which also has a great deal of Hebrew in it, so that when you have Tevye, his most famous character, saying his prayers, Tevye's prayers are actually a form of humorous praying. He says in Hebrew, Michalkel Chaim Bechesed, who provideth life with his bounty. And then he says to God, it better be all of life. Do you hear me?
Yes.
He goes from high register to low register, kind of puncturing, the conversation with God by his own observations that life is not exactly as you always promise it to be.
And I do like your metaphor of going from high register to low register. In a way, your book does the same. Jokes are in low register, but they are in many ways a relief from the burdens of having to think too much. On the other hand, the rest of your book provokes a very, very significant thought, and indeed is a major contribution to the literature on the psychology of humor itself, I would say. And with that, our revels now are ended, I fear. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I thank you.
I hope to see you again soon.
It's been a pleasure.